think maybe we should think about or consider dismissing this case. I think that that's the only right thing to do. Mm. I don't think this is salvageable anymore. Got no it. Matter how much I felt strongly about the case and mm-hmm. how, you know, I do believe and I still believe that there was enough evidence to show recklessness.
Yeah.
You know, because you just don't point a real firearm at another person.
If you're not ready, then go ahead and tell me you're not ready.
I object to you getting records. You've been intrusive into people's personal lives.
In other words, the car didn't hit him and he wasn't hit by the car.
I'm not a lawyer, but
are y'all keeping up?
Debrief.
Hello and welcome to another episode of I'm Not a Lawyer But
the Debrief.
I am Melanie, aka I'm Not a Lawyer But, and I am joined by my co-host
Gooseberry. How y'all doing?
And before we get into this episode, we want to give a thank you to our sponsor, which is BetterHelp. We are going to tell you more about them in the episode. All right, now we are going to switch gears and talk mm-hmm. about another case that has been taking over all of the headlines, and that is the Alec Baldwin case that resulted in a mistrial with a dismissal with prejudice mm-hmm. after 3 days. And we are so excited to have a very special guest join us to have this discussion, and that is none other than attorney Erlindo Ocampo-Johnson. So thank you so much for being here.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Did I pronounce your name correctly? Let me just
You did.
Sure. Okay, perfect. Cool. And so because there's so much to cover on this case, and we are not lawyers and you are, so we have all the questions, we want to dive right in. Can sure. you, just to start off, can you tell us what your role was on this case and like your entry into this case? Because I understand that you were brought on later, like not at the beginning when the charges were first like filed.
Right. So I was asked to join the prosecution team in mid-April, and I joined, I believe it was like at the beginning of the third week in April. They wanted someone with criminal law litigation experience and someone who had been a prosecutor, because I was a state and federal prosecutor for over 11 years. Oh, and then, of course, I've been doing criminal defense for the last almost 17 years.
So you got both sides.
Yes. Yes. So I've done both sides. So I was asked if I would be willing to be what typically is known as second chair.
Okay.
So it's a co-prosecutor, special prosecutor. And so Carrie Morrissey was still lead since she had been on the case for a while. And, you know, basically she was kind of like we call it first chair.
Okay.
So my role was to come in, get up to speed. And we would be dividing out the witnesses, who was going to cross-examine whom and who was going to do a direct examination of whom. And so that was essentially my role.
Can you, because we'll talk about obviously what happened on day three, but can you first tell us what Alec Baldwin was charged with, and then what makes up that charge? I never remembered the words because I'm not an actual lawyer, but I understand that there are components, right, that you are trying to meet when proving a certain charge and what you are putting across to the jury.
Sure. So he was charged with one count, so just one charge of involuntary manslaughter. And a lot of people call it like negligent homicide.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't necessarily, obviously, it wasn't intentional, or that we had to prove he intentionally wanted to harm Ms. Hutchins. So it's basically someone who engages in reckless conduct, and that they know or should have reason to know that their conduct that they're engaging in, excuse me, is placing other people's lives in danger.
Got it.
And so you have to prove a wanton disregard, is typically those are the terms that are used in the law, a wanton disregard for the safety of others. So when you engage in conduct that is essentially reckless and disregards the safety of other people, then, and let's say because of that conduct, death results. And in this case, obviously, Ms. Hutchins was killed.
Uh-huh.
Then you could be charged with involuntary manslaughter.
Got it. And so with that, and specifically with this case, what the prosecution is then saying is that Alec Baldwin was engaged in conduct that was reckless on the set that resulted in the death of Ms. Hutchins, right?
Right, exactly. So there are Screen Actor Guild's safety guidelines that basically dictate the conduct that an actor should follow, particularly as it relates to handling real firearms.
Okay.
So a lot of people say, come on, it's a movie, right? I mean, actors are rely on other people.
Yeah.
Well, while that is true, actors do rely on other professionals, you also have to look at who are you hiring to do to be your armorer. This is okay. a 23-year-old kid who was completely chaotic and just not anyone with experience, and everybody on the set could see it. Everybody could see that this young woman had absolutely no experience.
Got it.
So it actually caused two of the other actors to do safety checks themselves.
Oh.
So when these two other actors would get their firearms, they would actually do dry fires.
Oh, I see.
With their firearms to make sure that everything was this is something we learned, that everything was actually okay with the firearm. The evidence that we had was that Mr. Baldwin did not do that.
Got it.
And so then there was some evidence that he was basically, he mishandled this firearm on the set. There were some video clips from the outtakes. I'm not sure what they're called, but just video clips from the show, from the movie filming, where you can see him using the gun as a pointer.
Oh.
To point at things and people and just cocking it when it wasn't time for him to cock it, that kind of stuff. So all of this was going to be evidence that was going to be presented to the jury to demonstrate that this is a real firearm, but it wasn't being treated like a real firearm. And those safety guidelines require an actor always treat a real firearm as though it's fully loaded. Never point it at another person, and certainly don't pull the trigger until you're ready to fire. So these are the things that supported the what we were going to be arguing with the reckless conduct.
Understood. That was actually really helpful. That breakdown was so helpful.
Yes. Okay, y'all, we're going to take a break from the episode today to tell you about BetterHelp. I am guilty of this, scrolling through the internet and comparing myself to other people. Okay, watching them live their best lives. And I'm like, I want that car. I want that house. I need that money. You know what I'm saying? Comparison is the thief of joy. Okay?
Amen.
Straight up thief of joy. And it's real easy to compare your life and to envy other people's lives, even though we know, I'm guilty of this too. You know, you look at their highlight reel on Instagram and usually in real life, it's not like that. Okay. But look, therapy can help you focus on what you want and not what other people have. All right. Now, if you're thinking about therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. Okay. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient. It's flexible and they work with your schedule. So you fill out a questionnaire and they match you with a licensed therapist. And if you don't like that therapist, you can switch therapists. Okay. Until you find your perfect match. So stop comparing yourself and start focusing with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/lawyer today and get 10% off the first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/lawyer.
Lawyer.
Now back to the episode. This might not be in your wheelhouse, but why are they ever using real guns on movie sets?
That is very baffling to me. In fact, I was probably like many people in the public. It's a prop gun, so it's not a real gun, right?
Yeah.
Well, they just call them props because it's a prop, but it's a real gun. And I don't understand. In fact, I think they shouldn't be using real guns on movie sets. And that was crazy because, you know, they have guns that are made to look almost identical to real guns. And they're made out of rubber or some other material. So not sure why they use real guns.
Let's say we take the set piece out of it. It's not on a movie set. It's just a person who is horse playing with a real gun, pointing it at people doing things. This could result in the exact same charge if the exact same result occurred, right? Would it be the same?
Absolutely. And that's if that was And that's what I argued in my opening statement was this was a workplace. This is a real life workplace for many, many people. And yes, it's a movie set, but you still treat that real firearm as you would on the street. Yeah. And so that was the position that the state was taking. Got and it. I think the reason why the charges had originally been filed.
We have to set up with what the charges are and why the state brought them. So obviously trial starts. And on day three, the crime scene technician is brought to the stand. And during the cross-examination of her, Alec Baldwin's attorney, Mr. Spiro, brings up that on the last day of Hannah Gutierrez Reed's trial, a man named Troy Teske comes to the sheriff's office and drops off some ammunition that he says is connected and related to this case, and that he says he has been flagging for years at this point, 2 years, I think. So that bomb is dropped. A motion is filed. The next day happens, obviously, and there's a hearing, and obviously it results in this mistrial. I mean, a dismissal. I keep saying mistrial, but it is a dismissal, which is very different than a mistrial.
Exactly.
From your perspective, and obviously many of us have consumed the interview that you did with Chris Cuomo, but can you talk about what happens in your mind as you are sitting at this table and this information is brought up, and then the kind of chain of events that resulted after that?
Right. So let's go to last Thursday afternoon. So crime scene technician Marissa Popple's on the stand. Mr. Spiro's cross-examining her, and he's really focused on this ammunition. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, this is kind of weird. What is this all about? Why is he going down this road? And he's talking about this Good Samaritan. If you recall his cross-examination, he kept referring to this person as a Good Samaritan. And I'm thinking, what is he talking about? And I remember writing on a sticky note to folks at my table, what is he talking about? Who is this Good Samaritan? And somebody said, Troy Teske. And I said, who is Troy Teske? Oh. And so at this point, I have no idea. Nobody has told me about this. And it just never came up in any conversations that I had. And I've been on the case for about almost 2.5 months at that point.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I learn about this at the same time everybody's hearing about this, or at least the public. And so after the hearing on Thursday, I was told by folks on the prosecution team who this individual was. And my question was, why wasn't it turned over to the defense? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've always been, when I was a prosecutor, I mean, I was a very tough prosecutor, but I always believed in full disclosure. Mm-hmm. You give more and then we can fight about it in court. We can fight about whether it comes in, whether it's excluded. And as a defense attorney, I expect to be provided all the evidence, which doesn't necessarily always happen. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, come Friday morning, what I was told was, oh, these are rounds that have nothing to do with the rust, the rounds that were found on rust, nothing to do. They're very dissimilar. They're completely different. So, okay. So we come into court on Friday morning, and the judge, if you recall, orders that they be brought into the courtroom, and she puts on some gloves.
Her gloves and gets down there too. Yes.
Right. And Spiro puts on one glove, and you know, there she's asking that these rounds be removed by categories. And then I see three rounds that come out and they looked a lot and they look similar to the rounds that were found on the set of rust.
Okay.
At that point in my mind, I distinctly recall I made eye contact with Mr. Spiro, and he must have seen the look on my face because the look on my face was like, oh my God, this isn't good.
Uh-huh.
This is not good, because I'm thinking as a defense attorney at that point, I'm thinking if I'm the defense, I know exactly what I would have argued and these things should have been turned over. And so, you know, the judge then sends the jury home. I you know, she wanted to hear more evidence. And so we take breaks, and I'm doing some research, and I'm, you know, telling my co-counsel, I'm going to do some research. Let's see if, you know, there's anything you can argue.
Yeah.
As I'm doing the research and I'm reading the case law, I'm more convinced this is bad. This is a what's called a Brady violation, which is that U.S. Supreme Court case from 1963 that says you as the prosecution have to turn over all the evidence that could be potentially used for impeachment, material to the defense, could be used to keep create reasonable doubt. You turn it over. And right. if you don't turn it over, and for example, in this case, we're in the middle of trial, now you have prejudiced, you know, the defense has been prejudiced. Mm-hmm. And so my recommendation was, I think maybe we should think about or consider dismissing this case. I think that that's the only right thing to do. Mm. I don't think this is salvageable anymore. Got no it. Matter how much I felt strongly about the case and mm-hmm. how, you know, I do believe and I still believe that there was enough evidence to show recklessness.
Yeah.
You know, because you just don't point a real firearm at another person, regardless mm-hmm. of what you think, whether or not you think that firearm is unloaded, you just don't do that. But anyway, yeah. that's beside the point. Mm-hmm. The point at that point on Friday was this wasn't turned over. And what the hell else wasn't turned over?
Right.
And so at this point, that was my recommendation. And so then we came back from lunch and the judge, I was actually late walking into the courtroom because I was just having this struggle going, oh my God, this is not good. We're going forward with the hearing. This is not going to get dismissed. And the judge, I walked in and the judge had already pretty much, I think she was about just starting. So I had to sit down at counsel uh-huh. table. And so then Carrie did the direct examination of Seth Kenny. Mm-hmm. And then before Mr. Spiro started his cross, we asked to, I wrote a sticky. I said, I can't do this. I can't stay on this. Mm-hmm. This isn't right. I'm going to move to withdraw. And so we asked to approach, and that's when I asked the judge if she would allow me to withdraw, because ethically, I just did not think it was the right thing to do to keep fighting this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to quickly go back to Brady, because I was doing research about it, and obviously I'm not a lawyer, but following all of these cases, Brady violations, Brady material, that is mentioned so much. Mm-hmm. And in that case, that 1963 case, there's a man named John Brady, right? An actual person, and a man named Charles Boblett. And what happens is that they are accused, they're found guilty of first degree murder. But what happens is after that, in appealing, John Brady finds out that Charles Boblett admitted to the murder. The prosecutors never told John Brady this information. And that is why we call it Brady, because that information should have been told to him, essentially. Did I capture it?
You did. That's exactly right. And it's been, you know, expanded to, you know, basically cover anything that could potentially be exculpatory.
Okay. And exculpatory meaning could raise reasonable doubt or show that this defendant did not commit this crime. Is that accurate?
It's essentially, or for impeachment. So, for example, the bullets could have been used to cross-examine Seth Kenny. Mm-hmm. Because remember, for example, the defense, I think in Hannah, one of the defenses was maybe Mr. Kenny is the one who put these rounds with right. the dummy rounds, you know, these live rounds. And so my understanding from Mr. Baldwin's team's argument was these bullets could have been used to cross-examine Seth Kenny to maybe imply that
sabotage.
Somehow there was sabotage. Exactly.
Got it. Hmm. Got it. And so impeachment, like poke holes in their credibility.
Precisely. See, got you it. Should be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Is this the first case of its kind that you've been experienced in?
This was the first time that I ever, and I think probably in New Mexico, have had a case where something happened on a movie set and someone ends up getting charged.
I want to say I do agree with you about the charges and about individuals acting reckless with a real firearm. Even when you go to a shooting range where there's instructors and people are masters at handling weapons, you never point a gun at anybody at any point in time, no matter what you're doing, you never do that. So if he was around the movie set, that's literally playing around with the weapon.
Right. And you know, that was my position. And that's one of the reasons why I decided to join the case. I mean, at the end of the day, a woman was killed.
Yeah.
The little boy doesn't have his mom anymore. Right. And so you know, but my philosophy was, let's just put everything before the jury. Let's put everything, give it all over. And I remember distinctly saying, that's everything that has to be turned over, that should be turned over, been turned over. Yeah. You don't want to lose this case to a discovery violation.
Mm. Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah.
Here we are.
You mentioned on the other interview that you did, which I thought was so interesting. I'm trying to remember exactly how you phrased it. As a prosecutor, you're not an actual advocate the way that criminal defense attorneys, they are advocating for their clients. But as a prosecutor, you are, I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but can you just talk a little bit more about it?
Sure. So having done both,
yeah,
you know, and I think this is a problem perhaps that we see nowadays, prosecutors are not zealous advocates. Mm-hmm. Prosecutors are there to ensure that justice is done, to yeah. put all the facts out, put them all on the table. Defense attorneys are expected to be zealous advocates mm-hmm. and do the best they can for their clients. That's their job. Yeah. And the way that I saw my job as a prosecutor was, let's just put all the facts, put all the evidence before a jury and let them decide. Or if we're going to disagree, which I'm, you know, we had numerous disagreements with the defense, was yeah. let's go fight it out in court, let the judge decide and then go from there. And yeah. so, yeah, I mean, prosecutors, I think this is something that, I mean, if anything, it should be a lesson. Mm-hmm. For prosecutors throughout this country.
Yeah.
You're not there as advocates. You're there to ensure justice is done. And sometimes if you have to dismiss a case, even if it's the biggest case of your career, because there was a violation of a rule, a violation of the Constitution, you just do the right thing.
Yeah.
And with as much pain in your heart, you're going to go and do the right thing and you move to dismiss.
Yeah. Justice doesn't always look like putting someone in jail. It can look different ways.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's unfortunate. That's why we, you know, there have been people who have been put on death row.
Yeah.
Because you've had prosecutors who didn't play by the rules.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it, you know, that there are very honorable,
sure,
good, hardworking prosecutors, but absolutely, you always have to walk that fine line and, you know, make sure that you're not trampling on somebody's rights because you want that conviction.
Can you talk about what is a special prosecutor? I called you that, but I want to confirm that you were a special prosecutor in this case. Can you talk about what that is and why someone would be brought on as a special prosecutor?
So typically, for example, in Santa Fe, it would have been the Santa Fe County District Attorney to prosecute this case. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff happened and I didn't follow it because frankly, I never followed this case. I was called in my capacity as a defense lawyer to just to be asked some questions about involuntary manslaughter or like a couple of days after it happened. Mm-hmm. But then I personally didn't follow it.
Okay.
I didn't follow the Hannah Gutierrez trial. So I'm not sure why. If I remember correctly, I think the DA said she just didn't have the resources and the manpower to devote to a prosecution of this magnitude because it was going to be a lot of work and a lot of resources, and she couldn't pull prosecutors just from their caseload to just work on this case. Mm-hmm. And so then she, under statute, under law, has the authority and the power to appoint regular attorneys who are in good standing and practice law to act as special prosecutors on a case. And they are sworn in, and they are basically designated special prosecutors just for a specific case.
Got it.
Oh, cool.
And so the DA chooses you, like reaches out like, hey, do you mm-hmm. have time and bandwidth to do this thing?
Exactly.
Hmm. I didn't realize that, actually. I didn't realize that was the process and that you're just like an attorney in the community who is obviously in good standing, but like, they want to bring you in. That's really cool.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, anybody, I mean, which, you know, cause I'm a primarily federal criminal defense lawyer for the last 17 years. That's what I've been doing. That's what I do.
Yeah.
But I was asked because I've had that prosecution experience.
If you could choose, well, I guess you can choose a prosecutor or defense lawyer. Which one is there one that you like doing the best?
You know, I liked both. After this experience, you know, I think I'm almost tempted to go back to prosecution just because, honestly, what is going on? Why isn't everything being turned over? And I don't know if it was just specific to this case, but honest, as a defense lawyer, I can see how that could happen. And because I fight disclosure, many times, particularly in the federal system, because the discovery rules, and those are, discovery rules, as you probably know, are rules that govern the disclosure of evidence. Mm-hmm. The discovery rules in federal court are very government friendly. Oh. You don't get as much discovery as a defendant in federal court. It's better in some districts and it's worse in some districts. And if I were to be federal prosecutor in charge, I would absolutely change that. I would say, we're going to even the field here. Mm-hmm. You're going to be disclosing more evidence. No more holding back because, let's say, for example, you have a drug case where you do you have confidential informants who make control buys, but then you get a search warrant. All you get is the search warrant and the evidence and the report as to the search warrant. You never get the reports of the controlled buys that gave rise to the search warrant. So that's just an example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why not?
Right. Yeah. Right. So,
and the courts have said, you're not entitled to it. So you don't get it.
Wow.
Since we're talking about prosecutors.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I said, I like both sides, but.
Since we're talking about prosecutors, have you ever seen a prosecutor take the stand?
No. I've been practicing 28 years and I've never seen a prosecutor take the stand in a case where he or she is the prosecutor.
Wow. So we saw some history.
I was going to say, it's good to know because I'm just stunned. Like, what? And so to hear from someone who works in this field and to say you also haven't, it was quite the moment.
Yes. And to this day, I have not watched the full testimony. Okay. I've watched snippets of it. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And that was ill-advised.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is cringe worthy.
I have to ask because one of the cases that we've been tracking and covering is the YSL RICO trial in Atlanta, Georgia, in which there are a lot of things going on in that case. One of the judges was just recused, and there's a new judge. She recused herself, another judge. And so after having watched a trial like that, which has been going on for 18 months at this point, it was surprising to see the judge in this case dismiss this case with prejudice. I, like to have a lot of faith in our system and that things are done properly and that, what the verdict and the results are what they should be. But that doesn't always happen in all cases. And so for this to happen felt like, oh my gosh, like it felt like we got what should have happened. And I'm just curious if that, were you surprised by the judge's ruling? And did it feel like the same relief, I think, that it felt for us? Did you have that experience as well?
I wasn't surprised because when the evidence, I think everybody, at least the judge, the defense, and I, when we saw those three rounds that resembled the rounds that had been found on the set of Rust, I think everybody had a, light bulb go up above their heads, like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This is not good. So I'm not surprised. Was I relieved? I was disappointed. Mm-hmm. I was disappointed because, the thing is, had this been disclosed, it probably would not have been absolutely relevant to Mr. Baldwin's defense. Mm-hmm. And the jury probably or may have just disregarded it because really it may not have been relevant. But that wasn't the issue.
Right.
The issue was the disclosure.
Right.
Yep. So it was... I felt I did the right thing by asking to withdraw and stepping away.
Yeah.
When I saw that the right thing was not done by the state.
Yeah.
But when I heard the judge's ultimate ruling, I wasn't surprised at her ruling, but just the way that the whole situation ended, mainly because of the family of Ms. Hutchins, we'll never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, there is always that side to these cases. We say all the time, we cover them and, you know, we talk about them. But the reality is many times there are victims in these cases. And so we never intend to take away from or make light of the fact that there are victims in these cases. There are people on the other side of this whose lives have been forever impacted. So wherever you stand, I just, you know, we like to call mention to that. So thank you for highlighting that. A few questions I want to take from the Patreon. Were you going to say something?
Yep.
Go ahead.
Have you ever stepped away from another case? Was this your first case stepping away?
This is the first time.
Oh, it's a lot of firsts for you.
The first time in the middle of a trial. I mean, I've withdrawn from cases, you know, okay, when there's a disagreement, for example, with a client and we don't, I've withdrawn from cases. I've asked, you know, but first time I've ever done it in the middle of a trial. Mm. So yeah, that was the first time.
Yeah.
We've had a few attorneys join us and, have said how they have been on both sides as far as being a prosecutor and later becoming a defense attorney. In your experience, is that common? Do a lot of attorneys do that?
Yes. In fact, Mr. Spiro himself was a state prosecutor, from what I understand, in New York.
Interesting.
And then he went into private practice. So it's not uncommon. I mean, you get a lot of trial experience when you go work as a prosecutor, and some people decide to make it their career. Some people decide to go out in private practice. And since you've been doing just criminal law, a lot of people just go to the other side and do criminal defense.
Got it. In a situation like this, we can be specific or not, but just generally in situations like this, when there is misconduct or perceived misconduct or actual misconduct, are there actual consequences, repercussions, sanctions that can happen to an attorney when something like this happens?
There could. It just depends. I mean, there are disciplinary actions possible. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've already heard Mr. Baldwin's lawyers have notified the state, Ms. Morrissey and the Sheriff's Department, that they intend to sue. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that could happen.
Got it. Wow. I'm just trying to make sure I'm not missing any other ones.
And they would simply sue because they didn't turn in all the evidence. That's
right. Under New Mexico has a New Mexico Civil Rights Act. Mm-hmm. And because the judge found that there was this Brady violation, so he could argue there was a violation of his right to due process, his constitutional rights. And because that was violated, that would probably be his argument. Then he can sue under the Civil Rights Act.
I don't imagine you know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask anyway. Do you know how the defense came into the information?
I have no idea. you know, and that's a perfect example of the differences mm-hmm. between you have the zealous advocate and you have the prosecution who is there to do justice, and the defense wasn't obligated to tell the state how they learned of the information. The fact of the matter is that they were not given access mm-hmm. to those rounds, and they didn't have the report that was tagged under a separate case number.
Yeah. And actually, just a clarifying point, the prosecutors have to give all of their discovery evidence, everything over to the defense. Do the defense have to give what they have back to the prosecutors?
Only if they're going to use it as evidence. If they are going to introduce something as an exhibit, mm-hmm. then they're required to turn it over to the defense as well. I mean, to the prosecution, excuse me. But if they're going to use it possibly for impeachment, then no, they're not required to turn it over. And clearly this was quite a clever move in terms of they banked on, you know, that it wasn't going to be turned over.
Yep.
They learned about it. They were ready for it. And it was, as somebody said, I think a Perry Mason moment.
Yes, yeah. It felt like that. It definitely felt like that.
And right. It was crazy that they had the video that the officers. The
body cam.
Yeah, the body cam.
From the day it happened.
From the day it happened. That was also like, what's happening? How is this happening?
Yeah, they since they could get it under the Inspection of Public Records Act, they probably requested it under the Inspection of Public Records Act. I'm assuming that either maybe the attorney for Ms. Gutierrez alerted them, because remember, he was aware of these rounds. Mr. Teske, from what I learned, was going to be a witness for the defense in that trial. He turned out not to be. He was sent away. So maybe he alerted the Baldwin defense, or maybe Mr. Teske himself. I don't know. But the unfortunate part is that the state didn't make it available to the Baldwin team, and the state should have.
Yeah. Could you, since you were a part of this team, should this civil suit proceed, could you be called as a witness?
Probably, potentially, and not. Yeah, it's a possibility.
Yeah.
It's,
you're like, I'm not looking forward to that.
No, exactly. No, I'm not. I just want to go back to my life. My
No, I get it.
Practice.
I get it. Okay. I have two more questions I'll answer from the Patreon, and then we'll let you go since you've given us so much of your time, which we absolutely appreciate. I've already seen that a motion has been filed, which was quite fiery, from Hannah's team, Hannah Gutierrez Reed's team, about what has taken place. I'm sure you were not surprised by that. And I don't even know the actual question behind this. I'm sure, in your opinion, this is going to impact what resulted with her case.
It's possible. Now, I understand, because initially I was kind of baffled why they, because they knew about these rounds. They actually asked Mr. Teske to bring the rounds to court. But from what I understand, and I think it's the argument that Mr. Bowles, Hannah's lawyer, is making, is that he asked the state to test them, to have them analyzed and compared to the rounds that were found on set. That was not done. But he also has some additional arguments. My understanding is that there were some additional items of evidence that were not turned over to him before the trial. I believe there was a report written by the state's firearms expert that was not turned over and should have been.
Yeah.
So I think that, if anything, that might be where the judge may focus.
Got it. And then the final question that we have, people are asking about forced immunity and if you've ever heard of it. I'll give a little bit of context as to why it may be coming up. Again, I referenced a second ago the YSL RICO trial, and one of the key witnesses in that case, his name is Kenneth Copeland. He wanted to plead the fifth, was told the prosecutors that is what he was going to do. And then without his wanting, desiring, accepting, acknowledging, they were able to force immunity on him, preventing him from pleading the fifth and then being able to hold him in contempt when he chose not to testify. Have you heard of that?
Well, and that is usually what happens. And in fact, that's what the state did in this case. The state filed a motion asking the judge to grant Ms. Gutierrez Reed immunity, use immunity.
Right.
And so what was interesting to me, which I didn't necessarily agree with the court's ruling, was, well, she doesn't want to testify, but she could have granted immunity. And then if Ms. Gutierrez refused to answer a question, she could have ordered her to answer it. And if she still refused, she could have then held her in contempt or, but it's, I wouldn't say it's forced immunity. I guess it is forced immunity. But I mean, the judge can say, okay, I grant the state's motion to grant Ms. Gutierrez use immunity. So now she can't hide behind the Fifth Amendment and refuse to answer. She's going to have to be compelled to answer. So it was interesting because the judge denied the state's request to grant her immunity.
I didn't realize that.
Yes. Yeah. She denied the state's request because her counsel said, well, she doesn't want to cooperate, judge. She doesn't want to testify. She doesn't. Yeah. And the judge said, okay, then I'm not going to make her. Which was actually, I thought, was kind of odd, because I've come across this issue in the federal system where the judges, if someone's granted immunity, even if they don't want to testify, if they're granted immunity and they refuse to testify, the judge can order them, you are going to answer that question. And if the person refuses, they could potentially face contempt of court.
Yeah. Oh.
Wow.
Well, thank you for asking that question, Patreon, because I didn't realize that was the situation with Hannah. I had been seeing that she's supposed to testify tomorrow. She doesn't want to testify. She's supposed to testify tomorrow. I didn't know that the immunity part was a play in that.
Forward. Yes.
Interesting. All right. I think I'm just double checking. I think we have gotten through all of the questions. Thank you so much. This was such an informative, educational conversation. I'm sure you are a very busy woman, so taking the time out to join us and answer our questions, we so appreciate it.
My pleasure. It's great to meet you, and thank you for having me.
Of course. No Have problem. A great day.
You and too.
Nice meeting you as well.
All right.
Nice meeting you.
All right. That's crazy that the prosecution, that the prosecutor, that was the first time in 28 years she's ever seen it.
Yes.
What's going on with
cases? What's going on in the America system? What are we doing? What are we doing?
We got judges recusing themselves.
Recusing, and then we got judges being recused, judges recusing themselves, new judge being assigned. We got prosecutors getting on the stand and testifying. Yes. Like, what?
Because you got caught in lies.
America, get it together.
And then she's probably going to have to testify.
She's going to be a witness.
Man.
What an amazing conversation. First
Follow
of all,
your dreams, people. You can do it.
I will say,
you can be what you want
to be. Between the conversation with Attorney Johnson, as well as the conversation we had, it won't be on this episode, but the conversation we had with the jury consultant that we will also be releasing.
That's what I wanted to ask.
Between those two conversations, it does, while there are a lot of problems, it does give you hope that there are people in this system who are ethical. Not morals.
Ms.
Who
Bombas,
want things done right.
She basically said what Ms. Bombas said. She was like, that power.
Yes,
she liked being a prosecutor because she could help people.
Yes.
You going to jail doesn't mean that's justice, but you getting rehab
justice. Could mean justice a different way.
So she regurgitated what she said.
Yeah, 100%. That was amazing. Thank you to both of our guests for joining us today, Attorney Johnson, as well as Attorney Bombas. We will again. Oh, I forgot to ask her for information. But whatever we have, we will put in the description box. Please support them. Do all the things. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please support our sponsors as well. You support them. You support us. Okay. Make them come back and keep sponsoring us. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being here. What you guys say?
I'm really thinking, what are these prosecutors and defense lawyers? What are their group chats look like?
The group chat.
Can y'all imagine what they be talking about in there?
Hilarious. So if you are watching this on YouTube and not a member of the Patreon, please join. I'm telling you, we do these conversations live with the Patreon. They get to ask all the questions that we are missing or not thinking about, get to be a part of the conversation. It's a good time. Follow me on I'm Not a Lawyer, but on all of the places. Okay. TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. Where can they find you?
Goolsby, that's GOOLZBY on IG, and Building with Goose on YouTube.
And with that, we say bye. You gonna cue us out.
Court has been adjourned.
I love it. Bye, y'all.